You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and United Steelworkers District 11. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And United Steelworkers District 11 represents 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting worker rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products, and our condolences to the members of the steelworkers and the members of the machinists at Harley-Davidson, which announced that it is closing in Kansas City this week. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, two books, Black Detroit, A History of Self-Determination by Herb Boyd, who will discuss the impact of the labor movement that the labor movement had on the rise of the black middle class. And then it's On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of the Class War by Kim Moody. We'll find out what organizing possibilities are hiding in our quickly changing world. In the news, AT&T serves up small bonuses and big layoffs. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo, and it's about how the USDA proposed cuts in pork processing regulation. Is it safe for the workers? And employer for five killed at gas rig explosion has a history of safety violations. And finally, a decade of train wrecks. What has gone wrong? Now for the news.
News from our side, February 1st, 2018. After the massive tax cut for corporations passed, AT&T announced it would give 200,000 union employees a $1,000 bonus each. That's $200 million. Never mind that AT&T reported that it booked a $20 billion paper gain from the federal tax overhaul that will hand it about $3 billion extra cash this year, according to the Wall Street Journal. So they get 15 times what they gave away. Despite the windfall, AT&T announced it was laying off 750 people in a five-state region around Missouri. That kind of soured the good news about the bonuses. At today's labor media breakfast, Jeff Hayes from the CWA Local 6360 did the math. It turns out that all of those bonuses, which by the way were only for union workers and not everyone, could have paid the salaries of everyone to be laid off a year and a half. Then it turns out that the layoffs were a violation of the contract anyway, and CWA filed a lawsuit because it was the reason those people got laid off, was because AT&T was doing their work with the contractors instead of their employees. And that's a contract violation. AT&T was forced to cancel the layoffs. They're now asking people to take voluntary layoffs or transfers. Small victories. Saving those jobs doesn't help the 900 call center workers who are about to lose theirs because AT&T is offshoring. In addition, the union expects AT&T to announce a massive layoff of management personnel next week. According to a report by CWA last May, since 2011, AT&T has eliminated 12,000 call center jobs in the United States, closing and downsizing call centers across the country. AT&T uses third-party vendors in countries with low wages and weak labor protections.
And CNN's Ron Brownstein had this to say about Trump's immigration policy. The escalating struggle between the parties over immigration rests on a paradox. In the battle for control of both Congress and the White House, Republicans rely overwhelmingly on the places in the U.S. that remain the least touched by immigration. Democrats depend primarily on the places with the most immigrants. That contrast frames the inverse dynamic driving this volatile debate. Generally, it is the places with the least exposure to immigrants that are seeking to limit future migration over the objections of the places with the most. Even that paradox doesn't capture the full complexity of the conflict. At the federal level, Republicans led by President Donald Trump are now urging not only a crackdown on the undocumented immigrants, but also the biggest reduction in legal immigration since the 1920s. But simultaneously, more local officials from both parties across the heartland are trying to attract immigrants they consider indispensable to their strategies for maintaining economic vitality in a critical mass of population.
Cheon Wura and the Guardian reports, the tech titans of Silicon Valley like to portray themselves as fostering a positive working environment. Google's co-founder Larry Page said it should be like a family. But as I learned when visiting last month, the rhetoric does not match up to the reality. Google perks, such as gourmet food and on-the-job massages, aren't extended to the thousands of contractors who work for the company. Google says it is the biggest provider of public transport in the Bay Area, but its sleek Wi-Fi-enabled buses are only for Googlers. Today, over 1 million people in the Bay Area are on low-wage jobs that pay only $18 an hour, well below the living wage of $22 an hour. And there is a racial dimension. Black and Latino workers comprise 58% of the cleaners, bus drivers, caterers, and other subcontractors working for big tech firms, but only 10% of the core tech workforce. And the benefits and economic security of the better-paid programmers and product managers who make up the techies are curtailed by an employment structure that affords different rights to different groups of workers. Many tech workers are also subject to outsourcing and therefore cannot collectively bargain because it would violate antitrust laws. With wages stagnating, good jobs only for the privileged few, and housing and transport and schooling costs rising, more and more ordinary people are seeing the need for action. The news tonight was read by Christina Dismang, Natural E. I am JZ, Jen Zaman.
Hi, everyone. This is Bill Sundahl, and we are kicking off a champions match right now. So call in the next 7 minutes and get your donation matched by our generous champion. And you can dial 888-931-0901 and do that, or go to kkfi.org. Fund as many hours of KKFI's programming as you can and get your donation matched right now. 888-931-0901 or go to kkfi.org.
Woo-hoo! Champions
so it's pledge
win.
Drive. All you union fans out there, let's pick up the phone and call 888-931-0901. You can double your pledge by making this match.
The clock is now ticking. We've got 7 minutes, folks, 7 minutes to make this champion and challenger pledge.
Please show your support for the Heartland Labor Forum. In the studio with us is Christina Dismang, who is producing half of tonight's show. Christina is a relatively new volunteer and a union member. She's a member of the Teachers Union. What makes you come to KKFI, Christina?
I think it's the community. The community is what made me become more closer to Kansas City. When I first moved here, I didn't feel like I was part of the community. Then when I found KKFI, I felt like I was more in tune with what's happening in our community, the diversity with our community, not just mostly diversity in thought. People that I've get to meet here and listen to on the radio are people I don't think I would have ever met elsewhere. So because your donations, this happens. People get to meet all over Kansas City, all over the United States, and the world who may not otherwise have this venue. So I think it's a perfect opportunity. That's why I joined KKFI.
Great.
Who is our champion this hour?
Me.
Ah. Okay. So what are you throwing down, and what are we looking to meet?
I am throwing down $200.
All right. That's $200 that we need to beat or match. So that's $200. So you can double your impact by calling 888-931-0901. We have some lovely volunteer operators waiting standby and waiting to take your call. And so we're gonna try and make it happen this hour.
Don't make me take my money home.
Yes, because otherwise in 5 minutes and 25 seconds, that money will go poof and go into dust. So you don't want to be that little kid on Christmas Day that goes and sneaks down to go look at your presents before your parents go down there, because my mom always told me that they'll turn to dust. So if I go downstairs before they're ready. So everybody call in. Let's make this happen for the community and for KKFI.
That's 888-931-0901. Or you can pledge online at kkfi.org. And we do have some premiums, too.
We do.
You know, if you donate $90, which would take us almost halfway to that match, you can get a KKFI T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And this is our new old retro KKFI T-shirt, because it's our 30th anniversary. We're resurrecting the design of our first T-shirt.
Oh, no way! I wonder what was. Oh, I didn't
you
know
didn't know that.
No, yeah. I just thought it was like I just thought it was a cool tribal design. I really liked it.
Yeah, well, it is kind of tribal.
Yeah, it is. You know, I love it.
Yeah, it's a cool design, and we have women's sizes and we have men's sizes.
Yes, we do. Women's sizes up to 2X, and men's sizes up to 4X.
Right, and you can also for $150 get a guest DJ. Which makes a great gift for that music lover in your
family.
And
Valentine's Day is coming up.
Yeah, Valentine. Get your honey a guest DJ for Valentine's Day, and let that person, you know, play all the music they want for an hour on the air.
We've got 4 minutes to do that. So if you want to call in, it's 888-931-0901. We want to match Judy's $200 pledge. We want to match it or beat it. So please give us a call. Let's do this and double our impact. I mean, $200 will automatically turn into $400 when you call 888-931-0901.
And been around for 30 years? That's something that I didn't even know to now. I mean, with pledging here and now and donating money, we can last for another 30. Extra 30 years.
Yeah, make us last like make us last 30 years. I won't be here, but maybe you will, Christina. Yeah. This is the only show in town that covers the labor movement and working people.
And one of the only in the region for that matter.
Really, it is. It's the only one in the region.
Yeah.
And it's so important to get stories like the one we just did on Google and what the working conditions at Google really are.
Yep.
Not for, you know, the engineers, but for all of those other people who make Google possible. Takes away a little bit of the glamour of Google.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. So call us, 888-931-0901, and we need to go back to regular programming at this point.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so stay tuned
for
Christina's
interview.
We got 2 minutes
left.
All right, tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we will be talking to activist, actor, and academic Herb Boyd about his new book, Black Detroit, A History of Self-Determination, and learn about how the labor movement in Detroit helped bring about the black middle class. What inspired you to write your book, Black Detroit, A History of Self-Determination?
Someone was asking me the other day, like, how long has it taken you to pull this book together? And I told him, 79 years. Well, because, you know, the book is pretty much a part of my life. I grew up in Detroit, and so obviously it's, in doing a book like this, it's a matter of kind of going back and really digging into my memory bank and making sure that, you know, I recall a lot of the incidents and episodes and personalities and organizations and institutions, and that pretty much comprises the book. And then going to Detroit and spending a couple of long stints there to go through the museums and the archives and set up my various interviews, we were able to pull the project together in a very short period of time, mainly because not only my memory, but the memory of my mother. And her memory is just as sharp as ever. So I really kind of picked her brain and kind of confirmed and verified a lot of the stuff that I remember, and it's a combination of us going back and forth and me going into the libraries and the archives, repositories that I know very well in the city of Detroit, particularly around Wayne State University, where I spent 15 years. So all of that comes, they kind of coalesced, came together in such a way that it was just a mere matter then of like making sure I go back and forth with my agent and my editor, who, and particularly my agent, who's a very fine editor in her own right, and kind of refining and polishing it up and perfecting what I had pulled together. So overall, you're talking about a couple of years of work and came up with this particular book, and it's doing very well out there. It's amazing the kind of feedback. In fact, I just the other day was talking to some people who just saw the book, and they were just so amazed because they grew up in Detroit too. And that's one of the real uplifting things about this whole project, Christine, is that other people have read the book and they've helped me confirm and verify and make sure that there's some kind of reality and authenticity there, that I'm just not, you know, delusional.
Yeah, and one thing that I thought was amazing about your book, you're definitely a storyteller. You bring together so many different parts of American history, Detroit history, things start going on throughout history, especially when you brought together, I know, specific instance with Dr. Sweets, and also you bring in with Henry Ford. And and I loved how you're just a storyteller and you bring together these stories with this coherency. And that leads me to my next question. One of the parts in the book, you talk about the labor movement in Detroit. Can you tell me, how did that play a part in the rise of the black middle class in Detroit?
I didn't hear the part kind of broke off there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I just asked, how did the labor movement in Detroit play a part in the rise of the black middle class?
Well, you know, that is absolutely just significantly important to the, not only to this book, but the labor movement is so important to the city's history. It's almost impossible to talk about the evolution of the city without looking at the role of industry, the manufacturing, particularly the automobile industry. And that's something I grew up with, you know, because when you come out of high school in Detroit, at least when I was coming out in the 1950s, late 50s, the one thing you look forward to was getting a job at one of the big three. And it took me a while to get around to that because, you know, I worked at a lot of the smaller stores and organizations, institutions in the city before I arrived at Dodge, Maine in 1965 after I'd done a couple of years in the Army. But overall, not only with me, but looking at my mother's history in terms of her work, she worked for during the whole Arsenal of Democracy period during World War II. She worked almost like a Rosie the Riveter in various factories. So it's like going back and talking to her about that, as well as a number of friends and associates over the years, all of them with even longer experiences working at Ford, Chrysler, and even going back to Packard and Studebaker and DeSoto. They worked at all of those different plants, and have them talk about that experience. And begin then a lot of the other, it's more than just the automobile industry itself, the manufacturing of cars, but a number of related industries, you know, around the around that particular automobile concern, that are also very, very important in terms of providing jobs and employment in the city of Detroit. And so it's almost inseparable, you know, the kind of connection between how that city evolved all the way back to Henry Ford and when he made that $5 a day offer back in the 1920s. All the way down to the current stage, you know, the automobile industry has been key, but there's been other elements of that labor movement in the city that I examine in Black Detroit, that you begin to see how the labor movement itself developed there out of the industry and out of the automobile industry and into other elements of the UAW and the Teamsters and these other unions in which black workers were at the point of production. So the labor movement is just absolutely inseparable in understanding the history of the city.
And also my side question to that, what about black women? Did they benefit in the workforce from this movement?
There's no doubt about it. Black women were significantly involved at every stage of the labor movement in the city. Again, the example of my mother is being kind of a personification of that. She was not only in the factories, but worked in various other endeavors, the department stores, working in the kitchens, you know, the cleaning as a domestic worker, the household workers and the housewives, you know, of the city were very, very instrumental in holding the families together. And at the same time, many of them having to go off and clean houses, you know, out in the suburbs. And so that's an indispensable element of the kind of workload, the kind of workforce that was so critical in terms of providing the kind of income and the kind of solidity of the community. All of that, you know, black women was right there. And certainly during World War II, when many of the men had to go off and fight in on the various fronts, they left behind these job opportunities, and many black and white women, you know, filled in. They went to those factories, and they kept that whole arsenal of democracy going. But as soon as the war was over, of course, they had to go back to being housewives and working in various department stores wherever they could get a job. They no longer were needed in the factories because these returning servicemen, you know, those jobs were theirs. But while they were gone, you know, it was the women who kept that engine turning, kept that motor running.
And that I feel like that is part of the story that we hear across the United States during that time period. And I just, when I was reading through your book, I really liked the point that you did make it a point to bring out the voice of black women in your mm-hmm. book as well. And I think that is an extraordinary point as a storyteller that you brought forward, especially as a historian.
Yeah, they were just certainly there. And not only there at the in the factories, because when you start looking at the school system, you know, they were there, you know, educating our children. Of course, I was very, very influenced by black women teachers. And also, you know, a number of other organizations and institutions where they were key, as librarians, for example. You know, the ones who were in the various women's organizations, like a Fannie Peck, for example, which she was doing with the Housewives Union and organizing, you know, all kind of credit unions as a result of that. The role of women in the churches in the city of Detroit. Cannot forget that, because they were there to kind of hold the choirs together, to take care of the usher board. You know, they were like the deaconesses of these churches. You know, when they were not there, many of them were involved in and eventually got involved in all the political arena, too. Later on, you have Irma Henderson, you know, and people who followed. She's a pioneer in becoming one of the first black women on the city council. So you have them, you know, having some influence and some power, you know, within the whole religious spiritual arena. So no matter where you look in terms of the city's the multifaceted aspects of the city, you'll find that, you know, black women are very much involved there.
Can you tell us a little more about the Revolutionary Union movement and how it impacted black power within Detroit?
Well, you get, then you also you have you know, women involved in the political formations. No matter which one you talk about, the Shrine of the Black Madonna or Republic of New Africa, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, you know, black women were right there involved, right there with many of the activists, black men, who at that time, you know, were connected to these organizations, who were on the front line, who were concerned about, you know, police brutality. Again, you find that some of the outstanding, you know, fighters for equality and justice in the city. You know, that's one of the reasons that Rosa Parks was attracted to Detroit. And she came to Detroit right after leaving Montgomery, Alabama. Of course, she had family there, but she also had, connections with a number of other activists, you know, particularly women who had been involved in the civil rights movement. So she had that hookup in Detroit, and later on, working for Representative John Conyers, you know, gave her another platform from which to continue that struggle for freedom and justice that she had started back in Montgomery in 1955. So, you know, you have black women who are very much involved, you know, in the political fight, you know, in the civil rights, human rights struggle, whether they're like, Betty Sanders, who later becomes Betty Shabazz, and Malcolm X's wife, when you on the Esther Gordy, who's right there with her brother in founding, the whole Motown Music Company, to say nothing of the women who were there as performers and producers and songwriters. You know, they were operating on the entertainment front. You know, when you start talking about, you know, the waitresses, you know, go to the Flame Shop, they were there. When you begin to look at even from an entrepreneurial standpoint and working hand in glove, you know, with the Charles Diggs at the funeral home, a James Cole funeral home, you know, women were very, very instrumental in keeping these various businesses going. And when they were members of the Booker T. Washington Business League, you had a few there that was beyond Detroit, you know, because they were moving around the country. That league was very important as a part of organizing and galvanizing, you know, black workers. And again, you know, women were indispensable, you know, the secretarial commercial stuff. Even when you talk about the Nation of Islam, many people don't know that the key figure in founding the Nation of Islam, which of course comes right out of Black Bottom in Detroit in the 1930s, was Bernstein Sharif Muhammad. Because she had gone off to Commerce High School, so she had the clerical skills that she could take whatever W.D. Fard and Elijah Muhammad had to say and put it into kind of a format, a curriculum. Even the University of Islam was pretty much her brainchild. So they have a very significant woman involved in the emergence of one of the most important organizations in this nation.
That is, I think, one of the biggest parts that you really talk about here, the impact that all these industries had growing and the impact that people had on creating this industry and this workforce. Can you tell me a little bit, because we're getting too close to the end of our time, could you tell me, today we see a lot of new hip restaurants, housings, and businesses are popping up in Detroit. Do you think that's really going to be helping Detroit's future?
What you mean in terms of the that particular role they played there?
Well, the new restaurants that are coming up on Woodward, down by Wayne State, downtown.
Yes, yes.
Do you think that is helping? Is that going to be the future of Detroit, or do you think it's really going to be hindering the people of Detroit?
Oh, I think so, you know, because it has to start somewhere. And I think that's just a step in the right direction. You know, the whole development that's going on in downtown Detroit, now extending up to Midtown. And I think it'll come a time when it just has to go a little bit further. And certainly we're concerned about that in terms of how the capital is being expended there. And it has to be shared with the entire 139 square miles of that city.
Exactly.
And not just, downtown and Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes time. You know, I mean, you're hoping that that's going to spur some economic development beyond just those particular areas of the city. And if there's any concern about the activists there making sure that occurs, you know, there's every indication that they're going to put some power, put some pressure on the developers there to make sure that, for example, the end of the foreclosures that have gone down in that city has just been absolutely, you know, devastating, to say nothing of the street lights not working and the water being shut off. But you have organizations and you have the activists out there on the ground who are putting pressure, you know, and these developers coming in and making sure that the whole question of gentrification is dealt with, that affordable housing, you know, that we have some evidence of that, more so than the kind of promises that are made, you know, coming from the mayor, the governor, or even some of these developers coming in. But they're going to have to find some way to comply with that. And the only way they're going to comply with it is going to be pressure coming from the neighborhoods and the community activists here. And you can see that, like the Boggs Center, for example, the Carr Center, the urban activists coming with the whole black farmers there in the city. All of this here are part of a coalescing, a formation that I think will guarantee that the development spreads beyond just the M1 or Q line from downtown Detroit to midtown Detroit.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point that you are making about mm-hmm. the development, where we're starting somewhere. Detroit is starting somewhere. So as we're wrapping up right now, a lot of people are probably interested in where they can hear or see more of your work. Where can people, if they're wanting to find more of your work, where can they go to?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, Black Detroit is just one of my many books, and of course, in a couple of the others, where you talk about, for example, the Civil Rights Movement or Malcolm X's life, you know, you get some further information about the city's history. But I think they can go online. Obviously, the many of my books can be found. If they can just Google me, they'll see a wealth of my books out there, that they can find additional information, not only about me, but some of the subject matter, the themes and topics that I've dealt with over the years. And they'll discover that so often that Detroit is just absolutely critical in all of my studies and all of my economic and political and cultural development.
Thank you so much for joining us and explaining to us more of your book. And that was Herb Boyd. We were talking to him about his book, Black Detroit, A History of Self-Determination. And I am Christina Dismay.
So this is Judy Ansel again, and we've almost made the match. We need just a few dollars more. I want to thank Lon Swearingen. And I want to thank our noble engineer, Zen Jamin.
That was so funny.
And our other engineer named Jen Zaman.
Exactly. She's my evil twin.
Yeah. And you can call and pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum. Help us make this match. make me pay 888-931-0901. Call right now, and we will be happy.
Support for KKFI is brought to you by Folk Alliance International, presenting the Lewis J. Myers Music Camp, where pros can study with legends and players can learn from those experienced in the field. Class offerings include songwriting, banjo, bass, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, percussion, ukulele, voice, and more. February 16th through the 18th, 2018, at the Sheraton Crown Center. One-day and multi-day passes are available at folkcamp.org.
Change, now it's time for change. Nothing stays the same. Now it's time for change.
Hi, this is Kim Claus. For years now, we've been concerned about the effects our changing world is having on our ability to organize workers. Globalization, giant corporations, and frightening politics all seem to be against us. But in his book, On New Terrain, Kim Moody challenges some of what we are sure we know and shows how some of our world has changed, offers us new possibilities for workers and grassroots independent political action. Yesterday, I had a chance to talk to Kim Moody. Kim Moody, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Well, thank you for having me.
Kim, I really enjoyed your book, On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. How did you come to write this particular book, and why now?
Well, some of it just comes from research I've been doing for the last few years. But more particularly, I ran across things that I think the left and the labor movement haven't really been talking about enough. A lot of the literature that's come out in the last few years emphasizes things like precarity, You know, the whole notion that nobody has a job anymore. Manufacturing is gone, so the working class is gone. And in any case, there isn't the power that there once was. Well, I began looking at some of the changes in the way capitalism is structured in the U.S., but also across the world to a certain extent. And I came across things that convinced me that that narrative about the weakness of the working class, despite all the changes, just wasn't true, that there were new things that the way capital organizes itself in terms of corporate organization, production, transportation, these things we call logistics and so forth, have, as the title says, actually reshaped the battleground of class war in ways that I think open possibilities, and I have to say possibilities, not inevitabilities, for working class organization, unionization, and so on.
We talk a lot these days about the gig economy, and are we really in such a gig economy that organizing is much harder?
Yeah, that's one of the big trendy things, the gig economy. Of course, there is more precarious work. I wouldn't deny that. To a certain extent, there always has been, but there is more of it. However, I would argue a couple of things. First, just statistically speaking, most people have a regular job. Most jobs last a period of years, not weeks or months. Sort of the older you get, the truer that becomes, and so forth. But equally important, I think there's nothing inherently in the nature of, say, part-time work or even temporary work, agency work, and so forth, that is unorganizable. If you think about the history of labor in the United States and elsewhere, people used to work the shape up. They didn't have any kind of claim on a job. And yet in those kind of jobs, in transportation, docking, and so forth, the workers got organized and simply forced the employees to, even though they had multiple employers, they forced them to negotiate with them by using their workplace power. I think the same thing is true now. Even, you know, look at a warehouse. A warehouse today, and I'll say more about that later, but a warehouse today contains people, workers who work for the company that owns the warehouse, and many work for temporary agencies. Yet they're all in the same place. Now, you know, our labor law is about half a century behind the time, as we all know, and it makes it difficult to do these things, but there's nothing inherent, particularly since a lot of people who are called temporary workers today are really what we now call permatemps. They work there for a long time. Nothing inherently impossible about them organizing themselves along with the regular employees, and in fact, in some places, they're doing just that. So I don't think being in a precarious job per se limits the possibility or makes it impossible to organize.
And along kind of those same lines, in your book, you know, we kind of ask the question, is our working class shrinking to nothing? Who is our working class now? And they really don't look at all like the working class of 50 years ago, do they?
That's right. The working class has changed. One thing about capitalism and about the working class that it creates and that in turn creates it is that it always changes. The idea that capitalism has always been a bunch of big corporations that hire people from 9 to 5 and that's the end of the story has never really been the case. So if we look at the working class as it was half a century ago, there would be many more factory workers, many more people doing manual jobs and all of that. Obviously, that's changed. More and more jobs are service jobs, which is the first most obvious thing. But what's not so obvious to many people is that these service jobs are organized along capitalist lines. That is, workers who work for a big hospital corporation or a hotel corporation or some kind of transportation or warehouse corporation, something like that, our workers. They actually, in most cases, produce value. The companies couldn't exist if they didn't. And they have much the same kind of power, even if they don't wear the same collar, that they did, if, of course, they're organized, and that's the big if. The second thing is that, of course, the whole ethnic and racial composition, and in terms of the workforce, the gender composition, has changed radically in the last 50 years. And I think that's a good thing. I think now we have, there are very few industries anymore that are all white or even all male. There are still probably more of them. But if you look over the figures, you see that, for example, even in something like construction, which used to be considered a kind of bastion of white male employment, that a large percentage now of workers in construction, even in union construction in some places like New York, are minority workers, workers of color, smaller numbers of women, but still. Looking at the people who move materials, make materials, and all of that, my figures are that it's about 40% of the workforce are either black, Latino, Asian, or some other workers of color group. And larger numbers are women as well. And you can go into the service industry, and that's obvious, you know, as well. The proportion is pretty much the same thing. That's compared to what would have been around 15 or 16% for those major industrial groups 50 years ago or even not that long ago. So that's an enormous transformation.
Sure.
And to some extent, it shows up in the changes even of union members, even though we're losing lots of union members. Almost half union members are women now, and large percentages are workers of color. So, yes, we have a different workforce and a different working class as a result of that. But it's a more diverse one. It's one that reflects the country more. And probably what's most important is that it's a workforce that reflects the future of this country in terms of race and ethnicity.
If you are just joining us, this is Kim Claus with the Heartland Labor Forum, and I'm talking with Kim Moody about his latest book, On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. And Kim, you talk about lean production, worker intensity, and how these and other factors have made profits so large that corporations have to merge and grow to these mammoth proportions to be able to compete with each other. What are the pros and cons of this for labor?
Well, okay, the first thing is that mergers have been a sort of common thing in the U.S. economy for most of the post-World War II period, but they've changed. They're different. And the major reason for the mergers of the last, say, 20, 25 years have been the increased competition as a result of globalization and what that does to domestic competition as well. So if you're a big corporation making widgets and you want to increase your market share to increase profitability, a quick way to do that is to buy up your opponents, your rivals. And that's what started happening in the mid-90s. So that had two consequences. One is that an obvious one is that sort of fewer, bigger companies dominate almost every industry, service, manufacturing, whatever kind of industry it is these days, at least in the private sector. So that's one consequence. The other one, which is in a way more important, is that today's corporations have gotten rid of the conglomerate structure. That is, they've hived off the old kind of divisions that weren't their core product. So, for example, General Motors and Chrysler got rid of their financial divisions in the last several years. General Electric did the same thing. U.S. Steel dumped Marathon Oil. Companies are going back to producing what they used to produce. Now, for unions, I think that's a good thing because it gets us back, in a certain sense, to the kind of structure we had in the 30s when the industrial unions organized these big industries. When you had conglomeration, the union, you know, might represent workers in one part of the corporation, but not in the others, which made a completely different product. Now the opportunity is there again to organize these big industries and corporations and along the industrial lines that we used to have, and I think that's a real possibility. The leverage for that would get me into this whole question of the logistics revolution. I don't know if you want me to move on to that.
Sure, sure.
All right, this is the other big thing, the other big change, I would argue, in the last 20 years. There have been a lot of good books on it. Elizabeth Collins' book on logistics, Deadly Life of Logistics, and Bonachich and Wilson's book. But I think a couple of things are sort of haven't really been fully recognized yet. And one is that logistics as it is today, that is the movement of goods and materials in the economy as a whole, has changed radically. For example, today there are 2.5 times as many warehouses in the United States as there were 20 years ago. 2.5 times. So this is an enormous, and these warehouses are much bigger. So a warehouse today is like a factory of yesterday.
Right.
Enormous places with blue-collar workers, increasingly capital-intensive, and maybe we'll talk about the technology in a minute. But so that kind of change is important. The technology is different than it was 20 or 30 years ago, even though some of these things like containers and barcodes and so forth are old. A lot of the things, the technology is new. And what this has done is it's tightened the whole logistical, all the supply chains in the overall logistical system, not only along just-in-time lines, which have been there for quite a while, but increasingly time-based competition, as they call it in the industry literature, meaning that you have to get things there fast. And that gets back to lean production and all that stuff, that mm-hmm. is the pressure on workers at every point along the supply chain, including the transportation, the warehousing, all the factories out along the interstate and so forth. everybody's working faster and harder to compete with the, you know, next company in the same industry and so on. Now, what that means is that these supply chains are much more vulnerable than they used to be. That's point one. Vulnerability to strikes or worker action is extremely high, although it's interesting in management polls, what they say the biggest cause of disruption in supply chain is actually IT failures. but if workers were organized to use these vulnerabilities, it would give enormous leverage for unionization and for winning gains and so on. So that's one thing. The other thing is that as this whole logistics industry has been reorganized in the last 20 or so years, they have produced what are being called logistics clusters. And what I mean by that is that in around certain cities, take Chicago, for example, or New York, New Jersey, or Los Angeles, or Memphis, Louisville, there are quite a few of them, you now have concentrations of workers in transport, warehousing, other logistics functions, ICT stuff, the Chicago logistics cluster, the official count is around 150,000 workers concentrated in a finite geographic area. The irony of this, of course, is that all this outsourcing and supply chain extension and all that that began in the 80s with lean production was meant to get away from these concentrations of workers in places like Detroit or Gary. But what they've ironically done as is recreating exactly these kinds of huge concentrations of blue-collar workers. Again, a very, very diverse workforce in most aspects of this logistical thing, that have a great deal of potential power. You know, again, the power depends on getting organized. But this is all really happened, in a relatively short period of time. And often it takes time for workers to figure out how to use the leverage they discover they have in a job. And I think that's one reason why things have moved so slowly. But I think there is the enormous potential, particularly beginning in these huge concentrations around big urban areas, drawing on the basically reserve army of labor, people who have been unemployed for a period of time, creating this diverse workforce, enormous potential there for organization.
There's so much. I really have enjoyed your book on New Terrain. I think it reads almost, kind of like a nice roadmap of where we can go in a time where where some of us feel like it's hard to know where we go because yeah. Everything seems so new. And I can't believe we're already almost out of time. There's so much in the book. I would just recommend it for anyone okay. who would like to have some hope. But we've got just about 40 seconds left. If you could just, if there's any last thing you would like to tell our listeners, I think we'd really appreciate it.
Well, the only thing I would say is that in the slightly longer run, if any of these things happen, if unions take advantage or workers themselves take advantage of this new situation, and some are, we shouldn't be pessimistic about this, that means down the road that maybe bigger political possibilities are there. Right now, things could hardly be more dire, obviously, and everybody's going to run for cover for the Democratic Party again. But I think in a few years, once again, the Democrats will disappoint, and people will begin looking for alternatives. And if we have some new organized working class power to back up that alternative, maybe there will be a new possibility for politics in America.
Kim Moody, thank you so much for being with me here on the Heartland Labor Forum. The book, once again, is On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War.
Okay, thank you, Kim.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced on January 19th a proposal to allow pork producers to run slaughtering lines as fast as they want in exchange for conducting their own food safety inspections. As stated in www.thepumphandle.org for January 19th, it's a warped example of cost-benefit analysis and one that could have serious consequences for workers and consumers. Under the plan, the cost to companies of self-inspecting will be offset by higher production and thus higher profit. The USDA's calculations, however, fail to include the cost of injuries to pork processing workers that will result from increased line speeds. The animal slaughtering industry already has the highest incident rate of occupational illnesses than any other U.S. industry. Those include carpal tunnel syndrome, tendonitis, and other musculoskeletal injuries. USDA is giving the public 60 days to comment on the proposed changes. They should be prepared to hear from pork processing workers who will explain why raising the cap on line speeds will make their jobs less safe. Next, the remains of 5 gas rig workers have been found after a gas rig explosion in Quinton, Oklahoma on January 22nd. For much of the day, emergency officials were unable to get near the rig because of the fire. The new well is owned by Red Mountain Operating and drilled by Patterson-UTI Energy. One Pennsylvania reporter noted in 2012 that the Occupational Health and Safety Administration knows Patterson well. It has fined the drilling company more than $900,000 over the past decade for repeated violations. Just a few examples, from the Confined Space newsletter at jordanbareb.com, January 23rd. In August 2017, Adolfo Garza of Raymondville died after an incident at an oil rig in Rankin, Texas. In 2013, a Patterson oil rig worker was crushed and killed by a blowout preventer in Barnard, Texas. And another Patterson worker was killed January 27, 2012, in Keene, North Carolina, when a boiler exploded on the oil rig he was working on. Finally, a decade of train wrecks. What has gone wrong? From www.labornotes.org, January 24th, by J.P. Wright, organizer with Railroad Workers United. On December 18, 2017, an Amtrak passenger train traveling 78 miles an hour derailed on a 30-mile-per-hour curve outside DuPont, Washington, killing three people and injuring scores more. At the time, Amtrak 501 was making its inaugural journey of a new Seattle to Portland route. It's the latest of five major passenger train wrecks in the U.S. in the past decade, and it came during the criminal negligence trial of three workers indicted for the 2013 freight train disaster in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. On January 19th, the jury found the workers not guilty on all counts. Why do these tragedies keep happening? We miss the point when we simply pinpoint the worker who screwed up without asking why. Train wrecks often result from hidden factors over which the individual worker has little control, including poor work schedules, chronic crew fatigue, limited time off, inadequate staffing, lack of training, improper qualifying, task overload because of crew downsizing, deferred maintenance, antiquated infrastructure, and employers' failure to implement available safety technology. Check out the entire article at www.labornotes.org. According to another report at www.cnn.com, January 29th, Amtrak conductors and engineers say they warned their supervisors they did not feel adequately trained on the new Seattle to Portland route. The workers had safety concerns, citing rushed and totally inadequate training, which left them feeling dangerously unprepared. According to regarding the 2013 train disaster in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, the jury acquittal of the three MMA railroad workers, Tom Harding, Richard Labrie, and John Demetra, according to www.cbc.ca, January 19th, John Cluciolt, whose daughter Kelly died in the explosion, praised the decision outside the courtroom. "I felt relieved because these are not the right people who should be there," he said. The following is a portion of the statement from railroadworkersunited.org. All told, over the course of 4 months, the jury gained a picture of a railroad company that was oblivious to safety concerns, far more interested in making money than the safety of its workers or trackside communities. And finally, railroad workers must be ready, willing, and able to come to one another's defense to prevent the rail carriers and the state from criminalizing our behavior while they, the real criminals, get off scot-free. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And we want to thank Molly Madden for helping us make the match. And thanks to all the donors.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.